Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. October is Family History Month, designated by Congress in 2001 as more and more Americans were tracing their family lineage. In the last 17 years, technology has made more resources available than ever before for genealogists. The internet and DNA can provide information that we couldn't find on our own then. Family History Month is about more than tracing one's roots today. Joining us for this portion of the program is Aaron McWilliams, an archivist with the Pennsylvania State Archives. Mr. McWilliams, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Should mention that in the second portion of today's program, we'll be continuing our conversation with candidates. Incumbent Republican Congressman Lloyd Smucker joins us in the second portion of today's program. So, Family History Month, I have to admit that as I was researching for the program, Aaron, that there were a lot of suggestions and a lot of information other than just tracing one's roots. This is about more than just doing that, correct?
Yes. Family History Month is basically a month where you can not only explore your genealogical roots, but to celebrate your heritage and your ancestors. I mean, you don't just have to go through a family tree, but you can incorporate not only aspects of your family today, like the scrapbooking. You could use some type of art projects to celebrate the family. Some people, you know, take the time to just update their own family tree, but you can expand on anything, really. It's basically a time to remember your family, and I find it as a good reminder to talk to those of the older generation before they're gone, because that's the number one regret people have when they're starting out their family tree is, oh, I wish I would have talked to my grandfather, to my father, before they're gone.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just a couple other suggestions along those lines, oral histories, actually recording oral histories with your father, mother, grandparents, great-grandparents, other relatives in the family. Another suggestion I thought that was pretty neat is, because we often hear about this, especially around the holidays, is creating a family cookbook. Recipes collected from, it always seems to be the grandmother that has the recipe that everyone remembers, but that is a nice way to celebrate your family as well.
Sure it is, yeah. Everybody has that little tiny box with the 3x5 card. And that's a great time to pull them out and pass those on or teach the new generation about them. And in the same vein as doing oral history, you can do an interview. You can have them fill out sheets. There's books out there that you can buy at craft stores in some cases where, you know, it's basically just a set of questions. You know, what's your favorite toy? What do you remember most as a kid? You know, those kind of things. And yes, with the recipes, those are all great ideas. Yes, to remember the family.
So I mentioned in the introduction that one of the reasons that Congress designated October as Family History Month in 2001 is that there were so many more people who were interested in their family history. And that continues today. And as I also mentioned, technology, I don't know whether I'd say has made it easier, but has provided so many more resources. There's so much online today that you can find where before you had to, before the internet, you would have to go to the state archives physically, go to the courthouse physically, you know, wherever you were going. But why is it that so many people are interested in their family history?
I think today what you're talking about, in the past you did have to do a lot of legwork to do it. Now, you know, there's a lot online that can immediately get you hooked. Oh, you know, I stumble across something just doing a Google search of a family member. That leads to one thing and it leads to another. And I think the growing popularity of family history is largely driven by that. The accessibility of data now makes it easy to sit at home and just, I mean, you can go from yourself all the way back to the mid-19th century without leaving the comfort of your room, you know. It's just that much easier for people to access it. And it just, you know, it leads to that growth that's there. And I think that the interest in history and family history in general is people want to connect with the past. And the best way to do that, to get that personal level, is to, you know, identify a family member. You know, if you're interested in the Civil War and you're doing research on it, reading about it, what better way to make that connection than to find a family member that served in the Civil War and learn about their lives, how they handled the conflict or their service during the conflict. And that, again, just draws people more and more into, I want to learn more. You know, what, you know, why did he do it, or why did she do it? What was their life like at the time? It's that connection, I think, that people are looking for when they do the genealogical searches and family trees.
Everyone is looking for someone significant, that significant ancestor who may have served in the Civil War or another time in American history, or maybe even overseas history, that played a significant part. And I have to admit that, you know, I wanted to do this program in October anyway, but Senator Elizabeth Warren issue last week, where she announced that she had some Native American blood in her lineage, made me want to do this even more. I'm not going to ask you a whole lot about the DNA aspects of this, but what she was looking for specifically. Now, she was challenged by the president for that, but there are a lot of people who have heard stories over the years that I have Native American blood in me, or a relative did serve in a war or do something significant, and they want to kind of confirm those things. Is that part of what they're looking for? Why is it that everyone's looking for something significant?
Again, it's that connection. I mean, people are trying to attach themselves or their family to significant events in history. I mean, it adds kind of the feeling of, I belong here. You know, I'm part of this nation, this great nation's history. And I think they're all looking for that. And DNA is now this new branch of genealogy that is available to people that wasn't there in the past, that can reach beyond what the documents can tell us in some cases. And they really work together. I mean, you need both. You need to rely on documentation, and you can rely on DNA. They're complementary in doing your research, and especially with Native American and other roadblocks that people hit. I mean, you can only go so far in many cases until you run out of those documentations, or they're just simply not there anymore to prove that. And we get a lot of people that come to the state archives that are, you know, the family story is, I had a Native American ancestor, or, you know, we're related to this particular famous individual, Washington or whomever it may be.
Washington.
Yeah, Washington or Lincoln. Those are the two big ones. But they have that link, but they're lacking the documentation. And oftentimes they do turn to DNA testing, whether it's Y-DNA testing, autosomal DNA testing, or mitochondrial DNA testing. They turn to those as a means of maybe breaking through that wall, maybe finding an individual that may have that documentation or that link that you're looking for, or just simply, in the case of Native American or something, maybe find some type of evidence to validate their family story that, yes, we have, you know, a certain percentage of our genetic material is associated with Native Americans.
Now, I'm going to ask you to explain that a little bit, even though we're not going to talk a lot about the DNA, but we were talking before the show, and you explained a few things. I mentioned to you that last Christmas actually is one of my gifts. I got a Ancestry.com thing. It came back that all European, but it surprised me. It was like 55% Great Britain, 19% Scotch, Irish, and you know, very little French, which I thought Lamar was. But anyway, you were telling me, what kind of test was that I actually saw results from?
That would have been an autosomal DNA testing. I mean, you have the three, the Y-DNA, the autosomal, and the mitochondrial. The Y-DNA, of course, it can only be taken by men. It goes down the paternal line. It's the Y-DNA that we inherit from our fathers. Autosomal tests basically all those non-sex chromosomes, it basically pulls from that. So if you get 50% from your mother and father, you get another fourth from your grandparents, and so on and so forth. And it tests that. Now, you don't get equal amounts from them. There's certain dominant genes that you get. So it's not always exactly 50-50. Some genes are more dominant than others. And you can see that when you take a test. It's just not, if you were to assign a color to a kind of like an umbrella map of your genetic code going, you know, grandfather, great-grandfather, and so on back, it's going to vary in color and vary in thickness of what genetic code, what genes you've inherited, because they're not all genes are created equal. You do can get more from one family member to another. Let's say, you know, you have big ears or some other gene or something that may just be more dominant and will show up more. And you can get variants between individuals.
And that's why you hear stories about siblings. Brothers and sisters, or sisters and sisters, who have different results, correct?
Correct. Yeah, you can get variances in autosomal results between siblings and other family members, just because it's a percentage of DNA that you get from whatever parent or whatever line that happens to be there. So there is variation that you get there, but typically within so many generations, usually autosomal. I mean, I've heard ranges about how far you can really use it to test back. But I look 6 to 8 generations, some say up to 10 generations, but you're getting kind of far out there to really, I mean, you're talking about minuscule amount from certain relatives, but you have to do a lot of testing of their family to create that broad enough base to even say some of the more distant relationships are actually relationships.
But are they accurate then?
That's debatable. It depends on what you're looking for in some of these tests. They're not some magic cure. They're not going to tell you we have an ancestor. That common ancestor is, you know, John Doe so many years ago. I mean, you have to have a reasonable explanation or expectation in the result. It's not going to tell everything. The percentages are going to vary. Remember, a lot of DNA testing is statistical. It's based off of statistical models that have been developed in probabilities. So the percentages that you get, they're going to fluctuate. It depends on the sample population. And as more and more people take these tests, it's going to add to the accuracy. You have more data, more things to derive the models from and the probabilities from.
So as an archivist, what do you trust more? The legwork or the DNA?
Again, I think now that DNA is available, I say you need both. I always suggest both because DNA is not going to tell you everything, and documents can lie. You can have a birth certificate that could have, you know, the parents on it, and that might not be accurate. There are certainly, and a good example is, you know, some of the British monarchy and in the search, I think it was Richard, I forget which Richard, Richard III or whatever, when they dug him up, they took DNA samples of some of the descendants, and some of those didn't pan out right. So there was what's known as a non-paternal event that happened along there. So I think you need both. You definitely need to have documentation, because without documentation, you're really missing a lot of information. And when the documentation ends, or there's gaps or roadblocks, DNA can sometimes be that source that can break through, and you may be able then to continue on with it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Aaron McWilliams, an archivist with the Pennsylvania State Archives. We're talking about genealogy. Actually, it's Family History Month. Genealogy, a lot of other topics. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Aaron, we have a question from Mary in Camp Hill. Says her mom is 88 and not of clear mind, but the daughter knows that the mother had a civil marriage, married off by her parents at 16, her language, and it's only lasted several years. How can the daughter find out about that marriage? Who was the husband that took place 70 years ago in San Diego? Any suggestions?
By that time period, most counties or states were recording marriages. So if there was civil marriage, there would have been some type of marriage license, marriage application that was probably filed where they got married. that they can take a look at. Some of those records are on Ancestry. Some are available on FamilySearch.org in some way, shape, or form, but not everything. So it might be a case that you might need to contact, if they're in San Diego, you might need to contact either the city or the surrounding county to determine if a marriage application was submitted at some point in time. But most, at that point in time, 20th century, you're going to have the recording of marriage applications, marriage licenses. And even if it was a minor, 16 years old, there would have been some type of parental permission that would have had to have been signed off. And in most states, I don't know if California, what the minimum age was, but in Pennsylvania, if they were 16, then there would have been some type of parental consent that would have had to have been signed with the marriage application and license.
You know, one of the things I think of is, as I said earlier, there is so much available online today, free of charge. I mean, that you don't have to go through Ancestry or any of the sites that you do pay for. States, counties making all this information available. But birth certificates in Pennsylvania, for example, that is something that has to be paid for and is not available online, correct?
There is a portion that's available online, actually.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Yeah. If in Pennsylvania, we were kind of latecomers to the recording of births. With the exception of some cities, Pennsylvania had made a couple efforts. 1852 to 1854, there was an effort to record births. And then in 1893 to 1905, the counties were recording births. And then 1906 is when we have the state-issued birth certificates being implemented. Now, the 1852 to 1854 Pennsylvania births that are held at the state archives, those are available on Ancestry.com. And can be accessed free for Pennsylvanians if you go through the Pennsylvania State Archives website and sign up for a free account through Ancestry.
You just started that a few years ago, right?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some tricks to it and some learning curves to it, but it can be accessed free on there. The 1893 to 1905, 1906 county birth registers, those are not on Ancestry, but FamilySearch.org has a lot of them available online if you go through their catalog, and you can access those for free. Not all of them, but some of them. If they're not online, you could go to the counties or contact the counties. And then Pennsylvania birth certificates 1906 to 1910 that are in the Pennsylvania State Archives collection, or part of our collection, are available on Ancestry.com, and the indexes are available on our website. Again, you can access those 1906 and 1910 birth certificates for free as a Pennsylvania resident through our website, Ancestry.com PA link.
What about marriage licenses, death certificates?
Marriage licenses, there are some that pop up on Ancestry. They have a myriad of different databases. A lot of them, especially the early ones, I would say 1885, to early 1900s, 1906. It varies for the counties. Can be accessed through FamilySearch.org, a number of them, not all. Some counties have them available that you can find them on their websites. Death certificates, again, what we have in our collection, we're having digitized by Ancestry. So right now on Ancestry.com, you can access 1906 to 1966 Pennsylvania death certificates as a Pennsylvania free through Ancestry.com PA. We have the indexes on our website. And also the 1852 to 1854 are also on Ancestry.
Let's take a phone call from Heather in Lingolstown. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi. When back in 92, my dad died, I was only 18, and this lady showed up at the funeral. Long story short, she was my half-sister that I had never met, and she was adopted out. When I was going through my dad's belongings, I found a picture of a little boy, and on the back it said, "Steve, every time I look at our son's eyes, I think of you." I just want to know, he's deceased, I can't ask him, obviously, and I've tried to find, but like, is there a way to search birth records for paternal, for fathers across the different states, including Pennsylvania? That's my question.
All right. Thanks, Heather.
It varies from state to state what's available that you can search through, especially when it comes to birth certificates. As you can imagine, birth certificates, there's a lot more restrictions on than census records and other sources that you can search through. In Pennsylvania, birth certificates are open to the general public from 1906 to 1912 right now. Every year, an additional year is added. And when they're made public or available to the general public, they come to the Pennsylvania State Archives. Anything post-1912 in Pennsylvania, birth certificates are held by the Pennsylvania Division of Vital Records. And you would have to go through them to get copies of those birth certificates. Now, there are restrictions related to accessing those, and the indexes aren't available online for those time periods. So it is restricted to a certain sense in Pennsylvania. There are instructions and a list of individuals that can access it. So you could go to the Pennsylvania Division of Vital Records webpage, which is under the Department of Health, Pennsylvania Department of Health, and you could check to see who can access or order copies of birth certificates. But if the individual is still alive, it's really restricted to usually the individual or a guardian or power of attorney that can access those birth certificates. So it's not going to be easy to track those down.
Now, the DNA, they will identify if someone has submitted, if their DNA is in the database.
Yes, and that's another opportunity now that's available for individuals. And a lot of people that were adopted at some point in time are turning to DNA as a possible avenue because, again, adoption, the original birth certificates are restricted in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So DNA testing is a possibility. You could get tested. Autosomal DNA would work fine. Your half-sister could be tested too. But then you have to basically wait and see if any other individuals have taken the test. If it's only you two, then only you two are going to appear in each other's matches. It's kind of a waiting game. That's the downside of the DNA, that you won't get that immediate validation of what you're looking for. But that is another possibility that you could go down. If you suspect someone is, you could reach out to somebody and ask, you know, hey, you know, if I think the documentation is pointing to us as being related or some other, you know, reason you're suspecting that, you could reach out to them and ask them to take a DNA.
Yeah, mine actually went to eighth cousins and cousins that I didn't even know I had, not living here in Pennsylvania, but, you know, uncles and, you know, California, you know, a lot of that showed up that I was like, okay, who's this guy? Mike is in Halifax. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering if your speaker would talk about church records. There's a belief among some people that church records are public records and that all they need to do is call up a church in the area and that they'll have full access to the records of that church. I don't think that's true, and I think it varies pretty widely. I'll listen to the reply.
All right. Thank you very much for your call.
Yes, yeah, so church records are generally not considered public records. They belong to the church or the denomination. If it's a Catholic church, the records might be with the archdiocese, and they would control those. Or it could be just a small kind of independent church. Those records that they maintain would be housed and held by them, and they're not open to the public unless that church or the diocese or archive wishes to make them available. So we have a lot of people that come in that have had varying experiences with different churches. Some of them they contact and the church or church staff will take a look for them. Others will just say, you know, here are the books, you can look through them yourself. Others will not allow any access to those records. And it varies. I know that some dioceses, they restrict some of their baptismal records. Some older ones are available. So it does vary across the full spectrum, but in general, they're not public records in that you could just walk in and say, I want to look at it, and they have to turn those over for you to look at. So I always recommend that if you're interested in looking at not only at church records, but any records at all held by a repository, I would say just, you know, put on a smile, be as nice as possible, and if they say no, it doesn't hurt to ask again. Maybe you'll get a different person that might say yes.
Aaron, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program, and just kind of as a parting message, if you would, for those listening, and maybe their interest or curiosity has been piqued today, what's your quick speech on how to get started?
The best way to get started is to start with yourself. It's much easier to work backwards than to start in the distant past with some unknown individual or just a name and work to present. Start with yourself. Note information about you. Collect your documents. Move on to your parents. Definitely interview the older generations. Get their information before it's gone. And like I said, it's the number one regret. And if you're interested in DNA testing, certainly test the older generations before they're gone too. Every generation, there's mutations depending on the test that you're taking. Whether it's autosomal or Y DNA testing, the more family members that you have tested strategically, the better or more chances you're going to capture them in your DNA net. Like I said, just document yourself and start working back. You'll be surprised how quickly you can get back. And what makes genealogy most interesting is not just the dates and places and times. You need those things, and it's very important to get those. But it's the stories behind those people's lives.
One final question. How do you get those stories? Because I mean, I actually have made it back to 1650, but there are no stories there.
If the individuals are alive, that's where you can get it, you know, from the horse's mouth. If they're deceased, you hope they lived an interesting life. You know, you, as a genealogist, you hope that your ancestors got in trouble with the law.
Yeah.
You hope that they made news. Newspapers are often a great source to find those little tidbits of information, especially if it's a small town. You have those societal pages, those gossip pages, where it talks about what's going on in the neighborhood, you know. Those sources, if they're, you know, involved in crime, you can get, you know, police records, but court records related to them. You know, in some cases, if it's a small town and there's a crime that goes on, and if you're fortunate enough, the documents still exist, you can get a great deal of gossip of the neighborhood that's floating around at the time. Now, the further you go back, of course, a lot of that's missing. But if your ancestor was prominent, you can find more. And where it is missing, read up about the history of the time. I mean, if your ancestor was a farmer and, you know, minded his own business, well, read about, you know, farming at the time period. There are a number of different sources that'll give you an idea of really what their lives were like. And you can use those general descriptions to try and build up kind of the context of your ancestor's life.
One that I found, that Chronicling America,
mm-hmm.
It's a website with newspapers. And I've just typed in the name of ancestors, and I'm surprised. I mean, you're right. When you talk about the gossip and the little things, not just weddings, but, oh, so-and-so, Thomas Lamar visited so-and-so Saturday the last,
mm-hmm.
You know, and who these were the people who were there. Like, okay, that made the newspaper.
Yeah.
In small towns, I guess, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Know, they're hosting somebody from a different town.
Right, exactly,
you know?
Exactly. So Aaron McWilliams is an archivist with Pennsylvania State Archives. Aaron, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We continue our conversations now with candidates before the November 6th election. We're joined by 11th District Republican incumbent U.S. Representative Lloyd Smucker. The 11th District includes all of Lancaster County and the southern part of York County. Congressman Smucker, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I know you were born into an Amish family. You probably heard a portion of our last. What else can you tell us about the Smucker family?
I did, and yes, I was thinking that. In fact, it's one of the things that I've learned in my first 2 years in Congress is that I am the only member of Congress ever who was born into an Amish home, and you know, people find that somewhat amusing, interesting, but I often get asked how that affects my decision making, how that affects my approach to the job. And you know, one of the things that I'll say, just sort of tongue in cheek, but a lot of truth to it, is if everyone took as much from the federal government as the Amish, we'd be having very different discussions about the size of government and about individual liberty and all of that. But, you know, I'm 54 years old. The older I get and the more I have this great experience of serving, I really appreciate that heritage. You know, the Amish are known for the focus on individual responsibility, on strong family units, and on a real sense of community that I think that we can all learn a lot from. And I think those values also you know, are extended to the district that I currently represent and the new district as well. So that's my heritage. I'm proud of it, and I think there are a lot of those values that I've come to appreciate, and now really trying to advance those values in Washington.
So let's get into some issues. But when an incumbent congressman is running, it usually is a referendum on that candidate's record. This is one of the broadest questions or the biggest questions that voters would have. Why should voters send you back to Washington?
Well, I do think that's a great question. And I can tell you, 2 years ago when I first ran, so my background, I was a business owner for years and then served in the Pennsylvania State Senate for two terms, and now have served I'm in my first term in Washington. But when I first ran 2 years ago, I talked about, I thought that we could do better for the people of this district, for the people in the country, and I believe the best way to do that was to get an economy back that is working for people. And I believed that the best way to do that is create a tax structure that works, puts more money in people's pockets, asks for less money for government, creates a level playing field for businesses that are competing on a global scale, and then fix our regulatory environment, change that federal government intrusion into every area of our lives. I think I thought we had to pull back on that. That's what I talked about, and we delivered. I'm very proud that I've been able to deliver on the promises that I've made, and you can see the results. Lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, the highest consumer confidence that we've seen, that jobs being created back here in America rather than overseas, more money in 90% of the people that I represent, more money in their pockets. We've seen millions who've received bonuses and pay increases. Pay is actually, for the first time, we've seen an almost 3% annual increase in pay. That's the first time that's happened in a long time. So the people that I represent are better off now than they were 2 years ago. And I think it's a great record to run on, and we have a lot more work to do, and that's why I'm asking for their support for another term.
Congressman, as you know, there always is a but. And when we talk about the tax cuts that you have touted, you just touted as a big accomplishment. But yet the research has shown that the top 1% of income earners have benefited by far the most. Corporations have most often bought back their stock, and the middle class earners, even though there are some that have seen some increases in their pay, compared to the top 1%, it's not that big. Not to mention that the budget deficit is estimated to be over $1 trillion next year. So what do you say to those things?
Well, so you raised two important issues there. The first one is the fact that 90% of the people that I represent are seeing more dollars in their pockets, more dollars to spend on their child's education, more dollars to spend on whatever it is that they choose to spend it on. I just had a telephone town hall last week where a caller said they literally are seeing in their family $5,000 more spendable income as a result of the tax reform. Now, that's higher than the average.
Much higher.
But people are seeing a benefit from it at every income level. And then in terms of the deficit, CBO had scored this, that's the Congressional Budget Office, a number of increasing the debt by $1.5 trillion over a period of 10 years. Had I believed that to have been the case, I would have not voted for this package. But one thing I knew, and I serve on the Budget Committee, I spent a lot of time looking at our fiscal problems that we have, looking at how we spend taxpayer dollars. And I'll tell you this first. I had some idea that it was a broken system, and I can tell you it doesn't look any better from the inside. It's a crisis that we're going to face in the next decade or two if we can't change that trajectory of growing deficits. But back to this tax package, I was absolutely convinced, still am, I know, that you can't begin to change that debt and deficit problem with an economy that is only growing at 1.9% per year, well below our historic average and the average for the past 10 years. CBO was saying that was what we had to put up with. And folks, when this president was elected, when we were elected 2 years ago, people were predicting that you could not grow this economy at a 3-4% growth rate. And in fact, we were relegated to the idea that we had to have a tepid growth rate. The increase in the, we're now at 4.2% last quarter, an average of 3% growth. I think that will continue for some time. That in and of itself, the additional revenue that's coming in as a result of that growth is reducing the debt. If we continue at 3% growth, we'll see lower debt at the end of 10 years rather than higher. I expected that to work that way. It's working. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just 2 weeks ago that outlined exactly that. We are making up the deficit, or we are making up the income despite the revenue to the federal government, despite the lower rates. That additional economic growth is resulting in higher revenue. By the way, this is our highest revenue year ever. Even though the rates have been cut, that additional growth has made that up. We've seen more revenue this year than last year and every other year before that.
But why are you optimistic that growth will continue when the tax cut package put a sunset on the tax cuts for individuals? Now, corporations, it continues, but there is a deadline when those tax cuts will expire on individuals.
Yeah, so we had to work within the framework of a budget resolution because we had absolutely no Democrat support for this. Right now there's a 10-year sunset. We had to do that. But we've already introduced Tax Reform 2.0, which would ensure that those benefits for the middle class are permanent. I supported that concept initially, continue to support that. Unfortunately, we've had absolutely no support from the other side on this. And in fact, my opponent in this race specifically wants to reverse the tax cut. She wants to raise your taxes once again rather than lowering. It would be not only counterproductive to it would reverse those dollars that the individuals that I represent are seeing, but it would once again cut the growth of the economy that is so important.
You know, Congressman, we only have a set amount of time, and there's sure. So many issues that I want to get onto, but I just want to follow up with this one. You had mentioned that 90% of the people have seen some increase in income, but as I also mentioned, that the research has shown that the great majority of those who have benefited are those who are in the top 1% wage earners. I mean, we have a wage gap in this country that it makes it harder for someone to be in the, you know, to get into the middle class, stay in the middle class. So it doesn't, I guess what some people would look at and say is that it's not fair that those top 1% of earners are reaping most of the benefits of the tax cut.
Well, if you look at it as a percentage, that just is not true. So if you were paying more initially, you'll probably have a larger cut than someone who was not paying as much initially. But we've not only lowered the rates for everyone across the board, we have increased the child care tax credit. We have increased the number of people who are paying no taxes at all. But certainly, you know, you get out and talk to people all across the district, and you understand that the best way to really provide that upward mobility, that idea that we can, you know, achieve, we can grow out, we can enter the middle class and we can do better for ourselves here in America. It's what we call the American dream. The best way to have that occur is to have a thriving economy where there are jobs available. You know, we have over 7 million jobs available today, right now. First time in a long, long time that we have had more jobs available than people looking for them. That means there are more opportunity for people all across the district.
Now, when you said it's simply not true, that that information comes from the CBO. But again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. And there is no doubt that the economy is really doing well right now. We're going to talk about some other issues in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We continue our conversations with the candidates. Today, we're speaking with Republican incumbent Congressman Lloyd Smucker of Lancaster County. The new 11th district includes all of Lancaster County and the southern part of York County. WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. Congressman, as I said earlier, as the incumbent, there are a lot of things that we ask that are, you know, pretty much what we would ask any incumbent, a referendum on the incumbent. One of the issues that I hear most brought up when it comes to Congressman Lloyd Smucker is about town hall meetings. You mentioned the telephone town hall. You have been doing that, but you have not had any in-person, on-site town hall meetings. And I hear, you know, people say, why not? Why won't Congressman Smucker meet with people face-to-face? Now, I know you do in your office, but in a town hall setting where people can talk about issues and exchange information.
I have met in multiple settings across the district where we've had an exchange of ideas, where I've heard from individuals about their hopes, their dreams, their concerns, ideas for legislation, whatever it may be. And that has allowed me to be an effective voice for the people in the district that I represent in Washington, D.C., and in fact, that is so important to doing that. So we've received every day over hundreds of letters, emails, and phone calls. We respond to each one of them. We let people know how we feel about the issue that they've written about, or we tell them we're looking into it. I've co-sponsored multiple bills as a result of input. We've had hundreds of meetings in the office. We have had dozens of roundtable discussions with folks in the district about issues like human trafficking, agriculture, tourism, workforce, manufacturing, education, whatever it may be. And then I've done multiple, almost 30 now, telephone town halls where we can call into thousands of homes and take questions over the course of an hour. And that's been a very, very effective way to communicate and get a lot of positive feedback on that. And then, of course, we're in social media. We have a website. We have a regular email and all of that. We have chosen not to do what folks call as a public town hall because we have a group in the area that is intent on disrupting them. We've seen that same tactic used across the country, but it's about spectacle and show, not a real discussion about the issues. I am always happy to have a productive discussion with any number of individuals. And in fact, what I've done is when folks come to me with a request for town hall, I say, come into the office and bring a half dozen of your friends and we'll sit around we'll sit in my office or around a conference room table and we'll have that discussion. And found that to be very, very productive. Also found that many times the people that are literally asking for a town hall aren't interested in that because it doesn't provide the forum for the spectacle and the show that they're interested in. But I'm very, very proud of our record of accessibility, record of conversations that we've had with the people I represent, and it's a great area to represent, and that communication and conversation is a critical component of that.
So this one group is keeping you from having the town hall meetings?
There are folks that are intent on disrupting every single public meeting that I've had. They've done that multiple times, and so it unfortunately sometimes hinders productive discussion, but we work around it best we can. And we've had, as I said, multiple meetings. I do spend a lot of time, every time we're back in the district, we'll go out to businesses, schools, civic organizations, We have a lot of meet and greets and forums and so on. We're just we're intent on having those discussions.
What does it say about our country and about your district if a congressman can't meet face to face with constituents in a setting like that? I mean, what's changed?
Well, I mean, so again, to be clear, I meet face to face with constituents every single day, but it is unfortunate. We have a group intent in the district on preventing that kind of conversation to occur, and it's part of a broader problem that we've seen across the country, and that is an increasing polarization and lack of ability to talk about the issues, and it's really unfortunate. It's harder today than it has been for people with differing political views to have a civil discussion with one another. And one of the differences today, and this is shows up in the polls, is that we too often have contempt for the other side. Sure, we oppose each other with various views, but we shouldn't hate one another. They're not our enemies. They're our opponent politically. But today, too often, there's a contempt. People today are choosing their friends based on political views. They're even choosing where they live based on political views. So it's really, really unfortunate. And I can tell you in Congress, the way I have worked to conduct myself is to really try to understand other viewpoints. I have great friends, both Democrat and Republican, and I'm a strong conservative. I represent a conservative district, but Congress should be a deliberative body. It should be a body. It's intended. It's designed to be a body where all of these different ideas and ideals and visions for the country can come together, and we sit and argue about them and talk about the direction to take the country. And we should be able to do that, yet respecting and understanding another point of view. And it's the way that I've conducted myself in Congress. And it's the way I think I think we need to continue to move forward in that direction.
Congressman, we only have about 2 minutes left, and I just ask for a quick answer here because I do want to ask about health care if we have an opportunity. But with that said, the commercials that your campaign is running against your opponent, Jess King, they're not exactly friendly.
Well, the commercials that we run highlight who she's associated with, and the fact that a government-run health care, which she is advocating for, wouldn't work. It allows bureaucrats to make decisions for your family rather than yourself. And it's expensive, $32 trillion over the next 10 years would double your taxes, and that's only one part of the socialist agenda that opponent is working to advance. She's part of a group called Justice Democrats, which was formed to move the Democrat Party far left. She is a radical leftist supported by folks from outside of the district who are literally paying her salary to advance that socialist agenda. So we think folks need to understand the choice that they have in this election. I think the visions for the direction of the country are more stark in this election. I know they're more stark in this election than any I have raised. I haven't run against such a radical opponent at any time before, and it's a radical departure from what I think has made our country great. I think it's about freedom and about the future of the country.
And she will appear on our program, Jess King, later this week. Congresswoman, thank you very much for being with us today. I wish we had more time. I only have about 30 seconds. What message would you like to leave with voters? And if you can touch on health care, that would be great.
Well, I think we've made some number of policy decisions and bills that I have advanced that continue to provide better access to health care, for instance, the CHIP program, community health centers. But in terms terms of where we're going to go with healthcare, and you know, I've talked to so many people who need access to quality healthcare at a cost that they can afford, and insurance at a cost they can afford. I think government-run healthcare is the exact wrong prescription. I think we continue to work to build a market-based system that drives the kind of innovation that we've seen in every sector of our economy, and that drives down the price. So it's a very different vision in terms of where we go with healthcare.
Congressman Lloyd Smucker, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.